Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Mangum Talks TV. I'm your host, Lee. I'm joined by my co-host, Spencer. Spencer, how you doing?
I feel like I'm setting my first foot upon the path, sir.
We're on the path. We're going down the path. Path has started in episode 3, which sounds weird, but if you've watched episode 2, you understand why. Episode 3 would be called the path. They sort of reboot the whole thing at the end of episode 2. Felt like a table-setting starter episode. Spencer, what'd you think?
Very much the same. I thought it was deft. It was well done. It very much felt like, okay, here's the journey of 1,000 miles. We're taking the first couple steps in what's going to be the arc of this season, next season. Couldn't even tell you, but this is where we're going from here. We need to kind of say goodbye to what we've been doing before to start fresh going forward.
How do you feel about Dina after this episode?
I liked her quite a bit. I think she was one of the standouts of the episode, of where she's coming across as being the more forward-thinking, the more logical planning, the one that's actually going to make this happen, assuming anything happens, when it comes to our pairing. I think she's an interesting character. I'm glad we're getting to spend more time with her. She feels like a very interesting yin-yang to Ellie, if the two of these are going to be, like, you know, our co-protagonists going on this journey. I'm hoping we're going to get her to bounce over to Abby and her crew at some point again. But if not, we've still got two interesting people to riff off each other, it seems.
Yeah, I thought the interplay, I think Dina's a very good character, and I think Dina had a particularly strong episode. I liked the episode. I liked that the way that Tommy's participation in the Joel revenge tour was resolved, or at least short-term resolved. I liked that. That made a lot of sense to me because, you know, we kind of batted that back and forth. I felt like he might stay. You kind of questioned me, like, well, would he go and help them try to get revenge for Joel? And obviously you could make an argument either way based on what we had of that character, but we both kind of felt like there was enough growth out of that character that him just going into blind rage and just chasing these folks wouldn't make sense. It'd be a bit of backslide for the character. I like the idea that he was supportive but wanted to work within the system, and then the system didn't really allow his participation, at least right now. I thought that was a great resolution to his participation in that.
Yeah, I would say probably all of my favorite scenes of this episode were in the first half, of where I love that we got to see some moment of focusing on Joel and Tommy's relationship, because really, looking back on things, their relationship has been almost more than Joel and Ellie the driving source of the plot. It was the reason that Joel really went out west, was to find Tommy. Seeing the two of them together was one of the first, you know, character interactions, longest running character interactions we've had in the overall show. So that quiet moment in the hospital, of where Tommy's getting an opportunity to say goodbye to Joel, of where he offers that very well-executed painful line of "give Sarah my love" as he looks on that broken watch that's followed Joel all of these years. All that was really well done. And like you said, it continues through. I've enjoyed seeing Tommy grow up. We heard, like, the very beginning of season 1 that he was the immature one. He was always getting in fights. Joel was having to protect him and go out and get him. But at this point, I fully buy him as a leader of this community, as a father, as a person who has weathered a series of storms and come out stronger for it. And while he's clearly broken up about Joel, you can see that he is a man with responsibilities, with wisdom, who is more than anything worried more about Ellie than his own loss and trauma right now. So all of that was really well done to me.
So we've clearly had a problem in our society of reducing somebody's story, journey to their romantic relationships.
Sure.
This is a reductive line of thinking that, oh, well, he was good until he met her, or he was okay and she was all right until she met that guy. You know, and it's usually simplistic, thoughtless bullshit that doesn't take into account a vast number of variables about a person. All that being said, I just want to caveat that immensely, because I don't normally like doing this, but I think it's evident that the character of Tommy grew significantly during the time and within his relationship with Maria, right? Like, she has been, that relationship has seemingly been very good for him in that growing up process. I think that's what they're trying to display, is that he got to Jackson, he had the responsibility for her, for others, for their children, for, you know, like all of this stuff that he didn't have before. that seemingly Maria was the gateway for, and he's become a different character. So I like that he didn't just grab the gun and just run off and he's ready to kill like Ellie is. Mm-hmm. But I also like that there was still enough of that love and that passion for his brother
that
he was willing to do it. He just needed the proper proceed. He needed the sort of proper process to play out, and it didn't.
Yeah, I think there's a certain degree of implication that Tommy needed to get away from Joel. That being around Joel, being in Joel's shadow, following Joel's commands, I stifling too far a word when it comes to his development, when it comes to him growing up.
I don't know, maybe.
Because it feels like that him getting away, making his own life, making his own goals, starting his own family, being with Marie, having a kid, everything else with respect to that, was necessary for him in a way that being with Joel never would have, I don't think, allowed. And I think, in some ways, Joel getting away from himself and getting out of his Joel-isolated, self-contained world was a necessary part of his own character development in a similar way. Getting away from the Joelness, as it were. Some early things I liked in this episode also.
Well, on that point, I mean, Joel's love can clearly be overbearing. He was overbearing for Ellie. I think it's a pretty fair read to say that it likely was for Tommy during periods, and that likely stifled Tommy's development and his ability to be his own person, right? Because Joel controls everything. It all runs through him, right? And it does that because he wants to protect, he wants to take care of. And a lot of people with a really protective gene can do that to people, can isolate them or can stunt their development. So I see that as related. I see like Tommy, his like sort of immaturity was likely related to Joel and how Joel approaches relationships, which also is connected to Ellie and where mm-hmm. her relationship with Joel and how where she's at developmentally right now too.
How did you feel about Joel being removed from the opening credits in terms of even like, you know, the fungal figure of the two walking together?
Look, man, it's a brutal world out there. He's been dead for 12 seconds. He's already out of the intro.
That is just brutal to your audience. That is HBO knowing, or Naughty Dog before them, knowing, okay, this hurt. People are still actively crying. Let's put as much salt in that wound as we possibly can, fast as possible.
I asked our listeners to write in and tell me, am I off base with being as sympathetic to Abby as I was?
I did too.
And what I got was, so everybody had like their own sort of wording of this, but it was a bunch of gray. And that right there tells me that starting Abby's story before Joel just like saves her and picks her up, like she's not a stranger when that scene happens, absolutely soften that character compared to how that story was told in the video game. Like, I'm sure of it, because the people who wrote in all said, well, I understand what you're saying and I do have some sympathy for her, but I am still angry. Like, you know, the stuff like that. And I don't think that's what people got from the sequencing in the video game. I think they got, who is this fucking terrible girl who just did this awful fucking thing, because of the way they told the story, which we covered at the end of the last episode. So I just wanted to go back to that. Thank you for the people who did write in. I'm not going to read any particular one of them, although I do appreciate them all, but it was a number of people saying some combination of the both. Now, most people were not quite as sympathetic to Abby as I am. Right. Yeah. But there's some level of sympathy and some level of anger. Yeah. Like it's a mixed bag.
Yeah. From my informal polling among my friends and coworkers that live around near me, I asked them, like, on a scale of like 0 to 10, what is your level of sympathy for Abby? Where 0 is, I want to see her die in a fire. And 10 is, I want to adopt her and raise her as my own. The average was a 3. Of where it was like, I get it. I understand why she's doing what she does. I dislike her for it, and it's all sorts of wrong, and it shouldn't have happened. But it was that element of, I get it. And that kind of moment of, I get it, I'm with you. Doesn't seem like the video game community got that or had the opportunity for that. At least maybe not at this stage. Because everyone seemed to understand her reasons are understandable, but not excusable. When it comes to working through this character, which, as you said, seas of gray, which I think is a necessary part of where the show's going with the when it comes to the tied across time relationship that Ellie and Abby are now going to have.
Yeah, and what is what is the therapist's name here?
Gail.
Yeah. You know, Gail.
Do you think Gail's right that Ellie is 100% lying with every statement she makes for most of this episode?
Well, I mean, that's kind of what I was going to talk about is I feel like Gail is starting to be the character that gives voice to the writers and the, mm-hmm. the sort of fourth wall breaking of like what's going on when she's just like, yeah, this person, you know, Abby, she just sucks, or Ellie, she just sucks. Like, she's just a liar and that's just what she is. And going, and you know, you can extrapolate some of her comments there to Tommy about Abby, because she's basically like, nurture is a small part of it. It's mostly nature. So if you take that on face value and apply it to Abby, then it would be a less sympathetic read of Abby, in my opinion. It's yes, you had this situation unfold that was dreadful. You saw your father just after he was murdered, and you dealt with the fallout of that. But a lot of people could have gone through that and not become the, you know, sociopathic maniac that you are. And that the argument there is that you were sort of born that way, and that this little bit of spark, you know, it took a little bit of spark to get you into this state that most people necessarily would not have had that reaction to. So I kind of like the idea of Gail as almost like omniscient narrator for us, like in little parts, like just dropping things where you can say, oh, you can take that line and apply it to how they're approaching the characters across the series. And they seem to be saying not very positive things about human nature. And certainly that if you are born with these particular impulses, that your whatever situation you're in is likely not to change that appreciably.
And it's a fair read on Ellie from what we saw of her originally, where Ellie's kind of always been Ellie. Like, even like our flashbacks, like before she met Joel when she was still with Fedra, she was still Ellie when it comes to her biting wit, her willingness to lie about everything, her somewhat standoffish nature to everyone else kind of random. That has been emphasized by trauma. That is, you know, her delving into herself from what she's endured, but she has kind of always been that way. That said, I don't know if I fully agree with some of Gail's conclusions about that, where she says, oh, she's a liar. I agree. And then follows that up with, there's not nothing. What did she actually say? It's something like, you know, there's nothing we really can do to help her. That some people just can't be
saved.
Some
people can't be saved, yeah.
I disagree with that, and I think that is coming from a place of being kind of jaded nihilism, or even like, you know, inevitability that's been wrapped up in this character from what she's had to go through. I think that Ellie is going to be a nightmare from anyone else trying to help her that isn't just trying to, you know, work with what she wants rather than try to direct her in any other place, because she's always been resistant in that regard. But I don't think I'm willing to go so far as to just kind of write her off or just kind of shrug when it comes to wanting to help her, which almost seems to be Gail's conclusion here. If Tommy, you know, you feel responsibilities to her, but really you should just kind of give up. There's nothing you can do. I don't agree with that message. I also don't think it's too of an extreme read when it comes to the character.
Well, it's a sort of wonderful message to get from a therapist. That makes me laugh.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. I also think that it's an interesting commentary / bookend on Joel standing up in defiance and saying, I saved her. Mm-hmm. And the read from Gail is, maybe you didn't.
You never could.
Yeah. Maybe you didn't save her. Maybe that what you saved the sort of the body, but there was no saving the mind kind of deal, that you weren't able, you know, you're never going to be able to pull her out of however she was born.
Maybe could offer another conclusion too, that it's not about saving people. It's about living with them. And that's the kind of choice Dina's made, is that she's not trying to save Ellie. She's trying to have a life with her. Maybe that'll still have a profound effect. I mean, that kind of what ultimately happened with Joel wasn't the process of trying to save him. It was the process of trying to force him to actually live in a way that he refused to do. That's not seemingly something that Gail is entertaining as a possibility for healing either.
Yeah. I mean, I have in my life been very much a control. I want to control social situations. I want to control professional situations. I want to often control people. And the happiest I've ever been is when I practice a level of acceptance about people and who they are and what they are, even no matter how imperfect that is. So when I see a friend or an acquaintance and they have something that I know is causing them problems in their life that maybe annoys me, my impulse in first 35 years of my life was to talk to them about that, try to counsel them, change them, help them, et cetera, save them, quite right in quotes. Mm-hmm. And what I've found is that most people don't want saving, and that if you can just practice some acceptance and try to meet them where they are, help on the margins. But for the most part, if you want to be friends with this person, you got to kind of accept what they are, flaws and all. That's the happiest I have been in my life, and have the, that's the best I've had relationships. Right. And you kind of feel like that's what Gail wants out of Joel, or wanted out of Joel, mm-hmm. is, you know, to accept, because that seems to be her mindset, is to accept people as they are. Not that she's not into the sort of the control and the saving piece that defined Joel's life to a certain extent and made Joel very unhappy for large periods of his life, right? Because he couldn't control everything. He couldn't, quote, save people when he noticed a problem, what he felt like was a problem. So in some respects, I feel like Gil's commentary, both to Joel and to Tommy, is very, very valid and something most of us that struggle with control issues can take. But it does kind of feel like, doesn't it kind of feel like what they're introducing is that maybe she's too far in the other extreme?
Very possible. Also, to speak on, you know, levels of extremes, the show's very much addressing spectrums of issues. The supporting other person, helping them live their life thing, you commented in episode 2 about how utterly feckless Abby's friends are, where it should have limits. There is supporting another person, and then there is actively aiding and abetting, like from a criminal standpoint, but also from a personal and social standpoint, of where it also can be a part of living another life with another person, not to try to control them, but also to take them by the shoulders, give them a nice shake and say, what you're doing is all sorts of wrong and not helping you, and I want to be here for you, but I need, there are lines.
Yeah, but what I would advocated for Abby's friends was to draw your personal line of saying,
yes,
I am not going to participate. I'm not going to participate in this because you're fucking nuts. I'm not participating in this, right? I'm out, basically. You have to have a tap out button. Like, I'm tapping out, Abby. When you pulled the driver out of the golf bag, I am tapping out. Like, this is too much for me. I feel like that's what I wanted out of those characters. And that's the thing that Joel seemingly didn't have, right? He was mm-hmm. never going to just tap out on a person. He was doggedly loyal to the end. He would stay near you. He would just want to change you and, you know, mm-hmm. change the situation or control you or protect you, or otherwise be in control. So, it's interesting, like a story that is very clearly about a bunch of other things does have this pervasive kind of theme mm-hmm. of control and accepting people.
One thing, we're talking about all things we loved about this episode. Can I mention one thing in the first half I didn't like as much?
Oh, yeah, please tell me.
The opening shot of the episode was gorgeous in its nightmarishness. That kind of charnel house straight out of hell image of zooming in slowly on Jackson, Wyoming, and just seeing all the fires and the burning bodies out front. Wonderfully well done. The fact that we take that and have a brief shot of Ellie screaming in the hospital, which was very painful, and some time with Tommy and Joel, and then just immediately go, and now 3 months later, I sighed and fell back into my chair of what, you just yada yada what I was going to find the most interesting part of this episode, I feel like. Of where, just give me a day. Give me like one moment of just seeing what that community is doing to rebuild to some degree. I find that community almost one of the more interesting things of the show. And the fact that they just kind of skipped it, like, okay, I get it. You're telling me that's not important. That's not what the focus of the show is going to be. But couldn't it have been a little? 3 months is a long damn time to just skip right there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to go back to what you've told me on this podcast, which is just a sort of reminder that it's a story about people, right? It's yes, there's all this environmental stuff going on, but ultimately they want you to focus on the interpersonal relationships. And, you know, and then all the fact that they held Ellie in the hospital for 3 months, I think is a part of it too. That seems like a long time to hold her there, but she did wake up seemingly out of her mind. Like she was seeing things and raving, angry. And then she also had physical injuries. So the 3 months is a long time to be in the hospital.
Yeah. I have never been kicked in the ribs the way she was, but I have to assume she had some more than a few that were broken and some internal injuries that came with it. When it came to her own, you know, not only mental, but physical ordeal of surviving through Joel. Returning to Ellie and Gale, though, Gale seems to be the view that everything that Ellie said was a lie. Do we feel that is true? And if so, what is the implication of that? Because one of the main things that you and I debated is, did Ellie talk with Joel? We were going back and forth on that. And here she straight up denies it in the most passive-aggressive, I'm lying and I don't feel the need to hide it that much way to Gale, who later says that she was lying. Does that mean that she did meet with Joel, or was she just doing a triple lie when it comes to, you know, the audience as well?
Wait, hold on. I didn't catch that Gale was saying that she was lying about having talked to Joel.
She did not specifically say that. And that's one of the things I'm kind of trying to dial out here. Where she just said, Tommy at one point asked, do you think she was lying? And Gale clarifies, I think she is a liar. I think everything she's saying is a lie. And I'm kind of trying to extrapolate that out as saying, well, we heard a lot of things from Ellie this episode, including one you and I went back and forth on. Was that a lie, or is there some kind of triple bluff at play there when it comes to whether she met with Joel or not?
So these are all different things, I feel like. I mean, I feel like what they were talking about, Gail and Tommy, was when she stood up in the council meeting and had her thing. And she never addressed if she talked to Joel that night. Then she talked to, she addressed that later, right, to Dina.
She addressed it earlier when she was talking with Gale, is where Gale brought up, you know.
To Gale. That's right. At the hospital. You're right. So I feel like these are kind of different things. I think that she was being honest when she talked to Joel, to Gale about when she mentioned that she didn't talk to him since. Mm-hmm. I think that was honest. And I think that the actor gives you some clues about when she's not perfectly, but when she's being honest, when usually it's almost like the sort of, it's like when I'm asking you how you're doing, like a husband's, or how you really doing, like, how are you feeling? That tone of like, yeah, can we just get on to the next thing? Like that's what Ellie's tone is when she's talking, and it feels like she's telling or giving a fact that might be true. And when she's bullshitting, she settles into the lie. I mean, she's like, yeah, she'll just fucking go long for him when she's lying. And most of what she was saying at the hospital with Gil was a lie. And I felt like everything she was saying in front of the council was a lie. I think that like of those two sequences, we're probably getting like 90% bullshit, but I tend to think we got a honesty based on the circumstances that we saw, which was her walking past Joel that night. She did not stop and talk to him. Mm-hmm. And then also the way it was delivered tells me that she might've been telling the truth about that. Her last conversation with Joel was out there on the dance floor, New Year's Eve.
I'm with you that she was straight up lying every word she said to the council. And I almost feel like if she'd adopted a bit of a page from Seth's book, it might have worked better. That the fact that everyone knows her and knows she's full of shit, I think undermined her speech a bit. Like she was trying to aim it for the audience, but forgetting the audience knows her. And I think that undermined her overall success. If she just kind of straight up said, no, they killed one of us, that's fucked up, we need to get revenge on that, otherwise they're going to do it again or whatever else, same way Seth was saying, I almost feel like that would have landed a bit better, because everyone's like, okay, well, we can trust her that she's not full of shit about what this mission's going to be. I still don't think she would have won. Maybe a couple more votes, though.
Well, but this is where my town administrator hat would come on and say that, like, Ellie speaking was probably important for Ellie. People probably expected it, but, like, the vote should never have rested on what Ellie's impassioned speech. Like this is a question of resources and what the ethos of the town is going to be. And I don't think that like a bereaved 19-year-old, you know, standing up and talking about how she wants to go get vengeance on her dad or not should change any of the votes. Like she should, of course, have the chance to speak, but Ellie, I'm sorry, but it's about more than you. Like, it's not about you and how you're approaching this and the argument that she makes. I think that clearly there was at least what I felt like was being portrayed was that there was resistance to the use of the resources. And unless she could have made a different resource argument, I can do this job with four people. Here's how, you know, we can pick up horses along the way. I don't fucking know, but something to where they're not taking such significant resources from the town for this effort. That would have maybe changed votes, but not her logic in asking for it.
Yeah. You know, if she even just framed it as being, let's do an initial scouting mission, just me and a couple other guys, limited resources, we don't know anything about this other community. They may be a threat. They killed one of our own. We need to scout them out. that might have had better success, because I'm with you. This is still a community that is actively rebuilding throughout this episode, and the idea of sending 16 of their best to effectively here be dragons level of territory of the fallen United States was never going to sell well, and the fact that she was obviously visibly lying to everyone there only further undermined her cause.
I have a question for you. So we both felt like where this plot was going was Dina, Ellie, and Jesse leaving to go get vengeance on Tommy. It looks like
wrong
Jesse.
On that one.
Do you think we are wrong now or wrong that Jesse's never going to join them?
Certainly wrong now. I don't see any reason to think that he's just suddenly going to appear an episode or so from now. Whether there's some kind of... whether Ellie and Dina, you know, get on top of the hill and see that there's a freaking army occupying Seattle and instead tries to return home to get further resources, maybe. But it seemed pretty clear that, well, maybe it's a double bluff, maybe it's a red herring, but everyone seemed to be of the view that, no, he's on the council, he's following in the footsteps of Tommy, he's going to be the future, like, stand-in for Marie, chancellor of this community. They're not even going to ask, because there's no chance of that happening. That could be a red herring. You may just show up an episode or two from now, but show seems to be leaning very heavily in favor of, no, he's a fellow pillar of this community. He's kind of a bridge because of his close relationship with these two, but this is not his quest. He also has no personal stake in it other than his relationship with the two of them, because we never got to see that he had like a close relationship with Joel in the same way that Dina did. For when Dina tells us, I loved him too, I have zero doubts about that in terms of her own feelings about Joel and her own reasons for getting in this, beyond just simply her apparent feelings for Ellie. Haven't gotten that from as many people, though, in fairness, when Ellie returns home, which is probably my favorite scene of the episode, and sees all of those commemorations and flowers and everything else lining their fence when they get home, it is apparent that Joel, as we kind of called out what we saw in episode 1/2, did actually set down roots in this community and better it in a way that people acknowledged and appreciated and valued. So I did like to see that. And otherwise, yeah, seeing Ellie roam an empty house, silent crying, hugging coats, all that was incredibly well done for me.
Have you been playing a lot of poker lately? You said double bluff and triple bluff here. I just wonder if you're like, are you hitting the tables?
I may have an addiction we may need to talk about later. But no, I'm not ready to talk about it now.
Do you want to talk about your feelings, Spencer?
When has that ever been true?
Not now, not never. Hey, so here's the thing. I talk about Joel and his need to control and protect and sort of dominate in a, not like physically aggressive, but like in a sort of total existence of somebody. He sort of dominates with his relationships.
Yeah, as part of
protecting. And I've talked about that in a very negative light, in part because I've had some of those tendencies in my life, and I try to get away from them. And I recognize how destructive they can be. And certainly the show wants you to see how destructive they can be for Joel. All that being said, people who have that character trait tend to make a lot of friends and really have really close, loyal friends, people who really, because they typically spend an awful lot of their time doing things for other people. And sometimes it's not welcomed and sometimes they shouldn't be doing it, but they're usually giving a vast majority of their day. They're doing a lot of giving.
I think it's important for Joel that Joel we see a lot of in season one is at like an 11 when it comes to that, to the point that it revolves back into being self-absorbed because it's about his control. Joel seemingly, you know, settling into Jackson, maybe dialed that back to like a 7, maybe even a 6 kind of thing, of where it's still an element of control, wanting to control things, wanting to know about other people. But as we saw with the therapy, he was willing to give Ellie space. And I think people liking him in a way they never did before, people like valued Joel, respected him, but they never liked him for much of season one. We even had Bill straight up say that, of where, you know, I always respected you, never liked you, dear God. It seems like people honestly liked him because I think he dialed that element of I need to be in charge because I need to protect everything and I need to be in control back to a more manageable, healthy degree. And as you said, people do gravitate to that, having that source of that font of support, that element of inherent element of protection, that person you can count on and wants to, you know, once you're in his circle, you feel safe from it. People are always going to be drawn to that.
Yeah. I mean, that typically, usually those people have big funerals, right?
Yeah.
Here's how I would write this show. If I was writing this story, I would be advocating in the writer's room for Jesse to show up fairly soon with these two. And the justification for that is that he connected to Ellie's concept of we seek justice on behalf of the wrongs done to our own, and that's the thing that connects us, and that's important as a connecting element of their society to see that justice is done. That idea of like, I'd do the same for you. I want to rest assured that you do the same for me. It would be really interesting storytelling, in my opinion, if Jesse connected to that and shows up because of it. And then we already got the kernel here from Gail, but then maybe we learn later explicitly that was all bullshit from Ellie, that she didn't mean it, but that was the thing that brings Jesse to the conversation, because her point isn't a bad point. It's not devoid of merit. It's just that she doesn't mean it. Yeah.
If anything, you can picture Jesse saying that speech and meaning it far more than you ever could picture Ellie.
Yes.
Building off that, how did you feel about the Seth redemption arc this episode, or further redemption arc, maybe, if you thought he was being truthful back in episode two?
He's exactly the same guy that I thought he was. I mean, I think people can think bad things, say bad things, have bad beliefs, and not be bad people.
Sure.
And not everybody thinks that way. Some people think like, oh, if you are a racist, if you are a homophobe, if you look down on the poor, if you, whatever the thing is that I wish you weren't. Some people think that if you have that characteristic, I'm done with you. I just don't want any parts of you. And that's okay if that's your approach to life. But I think people are more like sort of varied than that and layered than that. And I think that you can be a homophobe and still have elements of being a good person. You can murder someone and still have elements of being a good person. Humans are like that, right? Yeah. And it's an abundantly frustrating thing about humanity. So we're not singular. I think that's the vibe I got from that guy, is that he's got this thing that I wish he didn't have, that's wrong.
And I'm willing to actually believe him when he said that I shouldn't have thought it, that he actually kind of meant that too, that it's like, this is what he thinks. He's recognizing that it's wrong and doesn't work for this community, and he's kind of trying to work through it to a certain degree. I don't know whether this is in his mind a certain element of penance. I kind of believed him being rather truthful that, no, him being a crotchety old man in terms of calling out everybody else as being victims when it comes to their response to this, felt like that wasn't just speaking up for Ellie in his own way. I think he actually kind of believed that. And him following through, I think he believes it too, but I also think that there is an element of, I need to make peace with this person because I may never see her again too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting, like, I think that fiction has value in our society other than just entertainment. I think it helps our empathy and it helps us understand perspective. And like, so take a book like To Kill a Mockingbird, right?
Sure. Great book.
That book, there, and Tom Sawyer is probably another really, or Huck Finn is another really good example of this, but there's tons and tons of these types of things where you get the perspective of someone that has an aspect of their character that is just bad, that they shouldn't have, that you don't want them to have, that they are a bigot in some way, that they're mm-hmm. awful in some way. But then there's all these sympathetic elements to them, and you understand their thinking and their logic across a range of other issues and topics. Right. I think that's interesting. It challenges the reader or the viewer to not paint people or situations with a really broad brush. This character fell into that for me right away. I felt like that's what they were doing with the character. So I have faith in this character. I think Seth will show back up and will be a fucking G for a lot of people. And it's part of challenging the viewer.
It does take somebody like Marie though, to call the person out when they do something wrong. Not like shame them, not ostracize them, whatever else, but still make them have that element of trying to deal with the person that they wronged or hurt. That is a necessary element of that too. It's just, you have to be deft about how to handle it.
What the viewers or the listeners to our podcast don't know is that oftentimes we get done with the podcast and Spencer will then tell me what he really thinks. A lot of times what he's saying on the podcast isn't what he really thinks. And when we got off the podcast at the end of last episode, he told me frankly that he really liked Seth, but it had nothing to do with his apology. It had everything to do with the fact that he made them steak sandwiches and he just couldn't get over how impressed he was that steak sandwiches made their way into a post-apocalyptic world.
See, I didn't want to make that my lead point, but it kind of like threaded into the last episode where I was emphasizing these steak sandwiches. I mean, dude, that is edible gold that he gave these people right now.
More important than their money.
It certainly is. Let's see here. What did you make? Let's finish up maybe a couple things with respect to Jackson. We can go on to what we're starting to see out of it. 8-3 feels like the perfect vote. And I'm waiting for there to be a bit of a trick about who the three were. Of where it seems to be that she's assuming that at least two of those are Tommy and Jesse. I think that's a reasonable assumption. I'm wondering whether there's going to be some element of a fast one, but the fact that it's 8-3, that does kind of fit. I'm curious to know who the third was.
That's such a good point, because I did this like thing where I was like, okay, 8-3, it's Maria, Tommy, and Jesse that were the three. Mm-hmm. And then I said, they probably want you to think it's the three. And then I said, no, they probably want you to question. They want you to think that those three are too obvious. So it has to be someone else. And triple bluff. What if it really was those three? So all that to say, I sort of settled on it was those three, but I took a long way to get there.
It's quite a path the show is sending us on, I must say. Let's see here. Yeah, Dina. We talked about Dina being the far more capable, reasonable one. I'm here for that. It's a fun balance to Elliot, who is all impulse. Remarkable amount of ability, remarkable capability, has a certain degree of aura about her, too. Different than Joel's, but people suddenly gravitate to it because of her intense focus and ability. But having somebody like Dina as, you know, your key supporter and friend group feels utterly necessary in a way that I picture Ellie otherwise just getting sniped the moment she walks into town, by comparison.
It reminds me of, so in the Fellowship of the Ring, Tolkien pulls together these characters that are going to assist Frodo in taking the ring to Mordor. And one of the characters is Legolas. And it seems like Legolas is sort of around because every once in a while they have to shoot an arrow a really long way accurately. Like, he's just got this like very specific purpose that he's around for. And it's like, okay, now we go to Legolas. Boom. He does that purpose. All right. Now we're back with these other characters. And what's weird is that I think that Ellie is kind of the same thing, except that Ellie is our main focus. She's our main character. But I think in like the actual journey to avenge Joel, she's much more one note than Dina. I think Dina is going to have a varied set of responsibilities and will accomplish a lot of different things in this mission. And I think that Ellie's mission is when Abby is alone, beat her head in. Like, who is going to be the one that can be brutal enough to actually go through with this thing and to kill this girl? And that's Ellie's job. But I don't know of anything else in this operation where I feel like Ellie is better attuned to do it than Dina is.
It's such a fascinating moment of comparison, because I have always thought, to a certain degree, and it's not fair, the characters are very nuanced, they're very well done, they have their own journeys, but a certain aspect of why are Legolas and Gimli part of this mission? Their role is to murder good. That's kind of their role.
That's kind of it, dude.
It is to the point of where they're moments the fans all love. They, at several moments, are competing on how many people they can murder how quickly. Nobody else is, just the two of them, because they are kind of the murder hobos of this mission. And it is interesting to see that Ellie is kind of the murder hobo, where Dina seems adept. We saw her take out, what do they call it, clickers?
Yeah, clickers, yeah.
She clearly is very skilled. But in terms of relative ability, Ellie's going to do the murdering, and Dina's going to do the planning. And between the two of them, hopefully they'll survive. They have gone into this mission with the profoundly false assumption as to what the WLF is and what resources they have to bring to bear. And we'll have to see if they're able to survive that. But accepting that massive falsehood, which they'll hopefully correct early, the two of them balance each other out well to make this at least a useful scouting mission. We'll see whether it's able to do anything more than that. In terms of our other supporting factions, did we ever get a name of the somewhat primitive scarified people that are wandering through with bows and hammers the wilderness?
No, they're dead now.
We know they had a prophet. We know that they seemingly were fleeing the WLF, because they talk about wolves hunting them down, and then they're all shot up and they cut to the WLF a minute later. So I'm guessing that they're going to be a certain degree of opponent to the WLF. Is there going to be an enemy of the enemy is my friend kind of thing going on here? Are there any survivors of them? Are Ellie and Dina going to team up with some larger group to then use that to get in to take the city, you know, Hernan Cortez style? I don't know, but they've introduced another faction and spent some time with them in a way that we haven't done as much before. So I have to feel like these weird, scarified, very religious people that are following the quest of the prophet and trying to find a new home and running away from the WLF, I have to imagine they're going to show up again. That the purpose of that scene wasn't just only just for the purpose of showing that the people that the Ellie and Dina are trying to find are very brutal and dangerous.
See, I kind of thought that's what it was, and I didn't know if I was like impressed or disappointed. Like because in one respect, I would be a little disappointed with that storytelling because I'd be like, man, that's you gave us a lot of backstory for something that goes nowhere, and like. Mm-hmm. What, but then also sort of impressed of like, this show doesn't even do fucking Red Hats. They give you, boom, here's a player card. Here's a whole bunch of backstory about this character. And cause we don't kill nameless characters. We give you something to care about them.
We want you to care at least enough.
I didn't know how I felt. But I did make the assumption that that was it for these folks, that they're all dead.
I'm leaning in favor that they've introduced them. They're another faction. They're in the city and they're enemies of the WLF. It may be just a pure Chekhov's gun standpoint, but I'm thinking that they're gonna do something with those resources rather than, you say, just use it as an emotional demonstration of the threat that our characters are entering. But I'm with you, it is certainly that. I'm just hoping/assuming it's gonna be a little bit more than that, but I don't know. Here's a question. Rating someone a 6 on a kissing scale, is that ever a good number to rate somebody on anything? Is anyone ever going to be happy with a 6 as a rating?
I don't know, man. You and I, like, we're kind of on the same page about how fucked up our rating system as a society has gotten. I mean, like, you know, you will very much, if I say, Spencer, what is the, you know, give me the rating of this episode 1 to 10. You will give me you did this in episode 1. You will give me a 6 and say it was good. You'll say it was a 6 and say it was good. If I'm grading papers of students, not that I teach, but if I did, and I gave somebody a C+ and they yelled and screamed at me, I'd say C+ is better than average. You did okay. Like, I think we've skewed so far.
Grade inflation.
We've skewed so far as a society. Everything's got to be like the GOAT. Everything's got to be the greatest. Everything's got to be A+. So I don't know. I think I might be with Ellie on this, that a 6 is not.
It's respectable.
It's not terrible. Like, it's not bad. She's lying.
She's lying. Let's not leave that behind.
But as established, thank you, Gail. She is a liar. But I would not say 6 is bad. How about you, Spencer? You make out with someone, and you bizarrely ask for a 1 to 10 rating, which I'm even struggling getting the sentence out that you would do such a thing. But if you did, and the person said 6, how would you take it?
Okay, just respecting the fact that you've painted an entirely fictional version of me that one would struggle to even put in print for how little it would resemble any conversation I would be physically or emotionally capable of having. Or yes. Accepting that as a baseline before I answer your question?
Absolutely. I couldn't even get the sentence out without stopping, but yes.
I almost choked. I'm glad you had some water there to help you through that. Are we assuming that it was a good kiss? And I've been in the same situation as Ellie of where I'm... Are we assuming it was a good kiss?
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I mean, you know, you thought it was.
Assuming I'm trying to, want to establish some element of human connection with the other person or just not hurt their feelings, I'm going to lean higher. 6 just doesn't feel like it's going to make anybody happy. I almost feel like 4 has a better response than a 6. If we're a 6th, the person's actually going to think you're serious or think that you're, you know, trying to be kind of dismissive. Whereas almost lower, you can play it off as a joke or make it constructive. And then higher, it has more, you know, like, I'm actually being interested in this further. 6 serves no purpose, I feel like, when it comes to rating another person's kissing.
Yeah, I think that Ellie had the right answer. The first word out of her mouth, the right answer was no. I'm not answering that. Yeah, I would not have given a number under any circumstance.
Maybe the better response would be... shall we try again and they'll be able to judge better or something like that?
Look at you, you snake. Yeah, that's right. I wouldn't give an answer. There's just no right.
I'm a scientist. No right, I need more rigor.
There's no right answer to that. I wouldn't answer such a bizarre question. But I mean, I think that that's just obviously Dina's flirting. She just wanted to talk about it some more. So that's all that was. We're supposed to care about the love connection between these two 19-year-old girls.
Doesn't seem to be vibing for you fully.
Well, the world is ending. One in her blood owns the secret potentially to saving humanity. And then there's also various paramilitary factions and societies springing up and all the administrative detail around. Yeah. So there's all that, but then these two might have a thing for each other.
You know, now that we've gotten to see what the medical level of support they have in Jackson, I know that everyone told Ellie not to tell anyone, but it almost seems like maybe sort of she should tell Marie. I don't know whether they have, like, saying they've got, you know, basic hospital is one thing, whether they've got a brain surgeon who's able to research fungi to develop a vaccine is an entirely other. But these people have more resources than I assumed, and I don't assume that Marie would be the person that would just put her on the chopping block right away. It feels like she'd be more, okay, thank you for telling me that. This is something we obviously need to research. You're a member of this community, so we're not going to sacrifice you. But we're going to need to obviously research this. And I think, like, Ellie would be okay with that. But again, the fact they've got a hospital is not the same thing as saying that they have the ability to cure the cordyceps.
Something about that whole part of the story doesn't square for me, because if Ellie was like, yes, I will go with the Fireflies so that they can kill me or whatever to get all my blood or get my brain or whatever they were doing to help develop a cure, and I'm willing to sacrifice myself for that because that's how much I believe in getting a cure for humanity. If that was her position, and it seemed to be, then why would she not scream it from the fucking hillside that she has this immunity to any people that she remotely trusted or thought were capable or competent, because she would want to continue to further that goal of saving humanity. Something about it doesn't jive, because I thought that the reason that she was told and she agreed to not tell anybody wasn't because they were never going to tell anybody ever. It was because they didn't know if they could trust the people in Jackson. Well, obviously they trust the people in Jackson now. So now it seems to have morphed into, well, I'm never telling anybody ever. But you just were a part of trying to use this and sacrifice yourself in the process for good. So something about it doesn't square, Spencer.
Except if it was like a promise she made to Joel, she would tell Joel, fuck you, at this point, and ignore him when it came to, not since his death. Now, since his death, it may become a votive or a sacred kind of promise.
What a word.
Beforehand, she would just kind of shake that off and just do whatever the hell she wants, because she was purposely distancing herself to Joel. Frog right out the window. Sorry about that.
I can hear the frog. Hey, what's up, frog?
I'm with you. I think it started with a certain element of we don't know whether we can trust anybody in Jackson yet, particularly Marie, because she took my brother away from me. But I'm with you. It doesn't seem like it makes perfect sense now, other than you just write it off as being she promised Joel and she was trying to honor that promise because she still wanted some relationship with him, even though she was distancing herself. And also she was distancing herself from anybody and not willing to trust anyone, to the point that she in this episode wasn't willing to even believe that Dina would have had her back on this in terms of planning or doing anything or someone that she could go to help for. This is the level of much that the degree to which she's isolated herself from the broader community. Maybe it's a certain element of that, but I'm with you. I don't know how much it tracks to me. It feels kind of weird. I almost wonder whether, has the show made these people more likable and made it more of a community? And that wasn't as much in the video game, so it's make it more believable? Because I'm struggling a little bit about why she's still sticking to that promise of not telling anybody. Or, hell, she even told some people. Tommy knew, right? Didn't Tommy episode one indicate
Tommy knows, yeah. It's, you know, it's weird to me. It's like, I guess it's realistic, but I have met people in my life who have, like, these entrenched, like, I don't do X. You know, I don't have pets. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, why don't you have pets? Well, because 40 years ago, something, and then that was my decision. And it's like, well, that whatever that thing was is not remotely relevant now. And it's like, yeah, but that's my decision. Like, you know, it's like people,
they don't reassess.
Yeah. And it seems like Ellie has not reassessed the decision not to tell them, because everything we know about the character is that she actually does support using her blood or whatever, to help people. She did. Yeah. And I don't know why that would change just because she you know, suspects Joel shot up a hospital. Like, why the fuck would that, why would that change? If anything, it should move her more that way. Right. Yeah. So it's confusing. And I think it's, as, I think, ooh, if you get the real answer here for the characters is it's as simple as what you just said. She's not reassessed the decision.
Is she also afraid of Joel? That I don't want to trigger this because I don't want Joel to do what I think he did already again.
Maybe, but she's had what, 3 months where she hasn't told anybody since he died.
Fair. Yeah. Now that Joel's out of the picture, the equation has altered in all kinds of mutually conflicting ways.
But that could be it. She could think, well, they'll just want to pawn me off. Like, if they find this out, they'll either like sell me or give me over to whoever the research arm left in the United States is. And Joel will kill everybody in sight. And I don't want that. Yeah. That kind of tracks for me, but it falls apart with his death.
I did like the touch of coffee beans on his grave. That was a nice callback.
That was good.
And beloved brother and father and the coffee beans of the grave, that was a nice touch.
You did get the sense that was the last time she'd ever see his grave, right?
Yeah, I did. Why did they... This may just be pure ignorance on my degree about not wanting to contaminate groundwater or what distance you usually put a graveyard away from a community. Why did they put the graves 10 miles away? That feels really burdensome to bring dozens of bodies that far away from the community. Dangerous, too.
No idea. other than space, maybe? I don't... That's
ambitious there to think you're going to expand 10 miles out sometime soon.
Yeah, that's a... Dude, you know what? That's a fucking level of planning for graveyard that our society has never had. Because we have put graveyards in some really inopportune fucking places considering the expansion of cities in the world.
That is some generational level thinking, I gotta say. If they're like, no, we need to put this 10 miles out because within 100 years we'll have expanded to that point, it would really interfere with our overall zoning. Kudos. Well done.
I've got a question for you about graveyards. So, I was just in Baltimore and I visited Edgar Allan Poe's grave. Yeah. And there were some graves there from like 1810, 1820. And it was, it is in the middle of downtown Baltimore. It is absolutely prime. I mean, it's like you couldn't get more downtown Baltimore. And so my thinking was, how long do we keep these graves here? Like, and I'm not saying we dig them up tomorrow, but what I'm saying is that if it's 500 years, 800 years, like at what point do you go, these people have been, honored enough here with this placement, and we got to do something different with this space. So I'm less interested in what you think society would do, and more interested in what Emperor Spencer would do. If you were given Palpatine level control over the world tomorrow, what are you doing with graveyards? Is there a policy? Talk to us.
If I have a certain element of control of where I don't have to give a damn about whether people are going to revolt, that I can just simply nuke that continent or whatever else, graveyards in my mind are just so massively wasteful. I get it. I'm a person who loves history. I love wandering through a graveyard, and I understand the importance to individuals to have a place of where they can think a loved one is, to go see them kind of thing. But graveyards, lots of land in communities that could be used for other purposes. As a person who like loves public monuments and has a lot of value there, I struggle extending that out to graveyards. Graveyards, they don't work for me anymore. I would make it harder for there to be graveyards or more restrict people's ability to use graveyards and encourage them in other ways that they can, remember their loved ones or support their, still have a emblem to their loved ones in their home, in their community, in their own house. Maybe make it easier for people to, have their own private graveyards in the way they used to, like in backyards or otherwise, rather than have a using up of public space that could be used for other purposes. Or, encourage people to plant a tree. Have some other kind of memorabilia that you can have associated with a loved one beyond just simply their own remains.
I realize I just sprung this on you, but I feel like putting it in backyards would compound the problem. Because then
you're making it harder for people to adjust their own houses going forward.
Yeah, you can't do anything with neighborhoods or develop anything. I mean, yeah, it starts to become a problem.
Encourage the urn industry. A nice little urn on a shelf that can travel with you kind of thing. Do that. Or, plant a commemorative tree. Have a bench in a nice park kind of thing. All that seem a better support for the community and use of land. And what is
I caught your phrasing there. You said a place where people can go and think that their loved ones are. That tells me that maybe you don't yourself go to graveyards and like, you know, feel a connection to the person buried there. Do you feel like, no. Yeah, that person's gone. It's not them anymore.
I view the act of graveyards and needing to have a grave, particularly like embalming. Don't get me started on embalming and all that jazz in terms of like preserving the body and all that. For me personally, not trying to judge the people's beliefs and what they want. For me personally, it's all strikes me as being very weirdly ancient Egyptian. And I don't need that. I don't imagine that, you know, a person's spirit or some essence of them lingers about the grave. Kind of hope not, really. If I go to a graveyard and I'm wandering through a graveyard, I'm doing it for the sake of like history and seeing about, you know, people's lives and seeing the gravestones and the monuments, that kind of thing, rather than like going to a graveyard to my personally see loved ones and kind of imagine that I'm able to commune with them through the place of their grave. That's never, really never clicked with me.
Yeah. So I think that for me, I think that the idea that your loved one is actually there, I think probably a small percentage of people actually think that they're actually there. Like, you know, like sitting under the ground, like waiting for you to come.
There may be a number of religions that believe in bodily resurrection and that it's important to have the body.
Sure. But I think that if you take the aggregate of humanity, that's probably a smaller percentage of people who actually believe that. I think more people probably understand the utility of these things because of the immediate grieving process. Mm-hmm. So the utility of the graveyard decreases over time as the grieving process concludes for people isn't as immediate and striking, right? The need for Ellie to go see Joel's grave is really strong right now because she's still grieving. She hasn't processed it. It helps her to process. But, you know, over time, it will be less important. I say all this to say, after about 800 years, I think we can dig up that graveyard in Baltimore.
There's a statute of limitations on
graves. I think there's a certain point where it's like, we're not grieving these people anymore. I think we can get rid of these things.
Not to end what I thought was a perfectly solid episode on a somewhat negative note, I almost kind of chuckled at just the sheer exaggerated effect of the number of WLF fighters and vehicles that are wandering that one street for no apparent reason.
Sheesh.
I get you want to indicate that this group is massively more powerful than Ellie and Dina ever could have imagined or ever kind of thought, and this is going to be a serious threat and whatever else. But the fact that they're seemingly on patrol with like 100 guys and an armored APC and 2 armored Humvees, I was kind of like, you could have showed me half of that and I would have gotten the message. This level of scale felt a little bit like video gamey, at least to me, in terms of realism.
What the hell? Before we jump into our segments and wrap this up, what is the WLF? Can you, like, I understand it's like a paramilitary organization that now is in Seattle, and that Ellie and Dina are going to have to kind of run through them to get to Abby. Got that. But like, are they connected to anything that we know of? Are they connected to the United States? Are they actually a government? Like, do we know their express purpose for being?
This is not in the category of things I've been spoiled about for the video games. I don't know. But the only thing we know in show is that they are opposed to Fedra. We got that this episode, that they are an anti-Fedra group. That they seemingly are centered around Seattle, that they have military gear. Because when Joel saw the gear that Abby and her friends were using, his first thought was military. Then he went Fireflies. So they've got top-of-the-line gear, seemingly much more modern, better gear than what, say, Jackson Hole has, which is very, for what the state of the world is, great, but it's not like, you know, cutting-edge military. So if I were to just speculate, I feel like that this is a... Maybe they originated as like a rogue Fedra group that is now broken away from Fedra and the government and now kind of doing their own thing. Or it had a basis in the militia movement and has always been resisting some degree of government control once things fell apart. But they strike me as being very well equipped and very well organized to an almost unrealistic degree given the state of the world. And no, in my mind, reasonable way of thinking they'd be able to, in the same way the government is, manufacture new things still. I still feel like that they would be... Maybe they took over a National Guard armory and they're working off that, but the idea that they would have the resources to actually make new shit, that would strain credulity to me. So I don't... This is a weird group, and it's only getting weirder to me in terms of my ability to place them in the world. What we've heard about them is squaring less and less from what we're now being presented by the show.
Gotcha. Yeah, I couldn't tell if we were supposed to have made some assumptions about what the WLF are based on the limited amount of dialogue we've gotten about them, or if it's a watch and find out situation. So I was just trying to figure out if we were in the same boat. It sounds like we kind of are, that it's okay. We have a general sense of kind of what it is, where it is, but we still have a lot
Liberation
to learn.
Front.
Still got a lot to learn. Yeah.
Shall we go into some segments?
Let's go into some segments.
Would you like to do quotes or winners and losers of the episode first?
Quotes first.
I've got a few. Wasn't the most quote-worthy episode. I feel like I still had some good ones. Of where, give Sarah my love in the first 2 minutes hurt like a gut punch. Well done, Tommy. The utter sarcasm of Gail telling Ellie, who is visibly lying to her, at least not engaging with her, shit, if everyone were as healthy as you, what would I do for weed and booze? Bit later of where, I like this line, again, I don't know when we're certainly not going to see those people, but anybody else of this movement again in the future, but the line from the religious group, primitive, whatever else, father to his daughter, a prophet isn't magic, they're just people that see truths hidden from others and share that truth, no matter what the cost. So it was with our prophet. So it was. That's how we keep her spirit alive. Follow her words, we obey her teachings, but we keep ourselves safe. If we never meet these people again, I thought that was a very interesting line of processing their concept of religion and what a prophet means to them. So,
Good line.
If that is all that is, well done. The whole speech from Seth at the council meeting, I'm not going to repeat it, but I thought it was still well done expressing his point of view. And I think almost working in shaming some of the community for a half second. Ellie's speech, I'm not going to recite it because it was utter bullshit, but it was well thought out bullshit. And I'll give her credit for that, of where she was very much intentionally working to her audience. It didn't work. In some ways it was so blatant, I think it almost undermined her, but it did show a level of craftiness and planning on her part that I should not forget she is capable of.
I think that she's a person that's not a very good extemporaneous speaker, and people can often confuse that for a lack of intelligence. But she's clearly really smart, clearly, but she just doesn't think quickly on her feet.
Mm-hmm. Back and forth between Tommy and Gail of where, you didn't believe her speech? Did you? Of course not. She's a liar. Well, there's a difference between lying and being a liar. Oh, I know. And that one, liar. There's maybe one person she told the truth to, and he's... But we can agree to disagree about that. That was a well-done interchange. I like the distinction of kind of pondering out what's the difference between a person who's lying and being a liar. And there are different perspectives on that. And then building on to that, Gail's speech to Tommy, you summarized a lot of it as is in terms of assessing Ellie as a character. I thought that was very interesting. I don't necessarily fully agree with Gail, but from a philosophical standpoint, I'm with you. This is what the show wants us to be thinking about. Whether we agree with this character, whether it's an accurate read on another character, whether this is going to be that character's journey. Is this the prophet? Is this a prophet speaking? Is this an oracle from on high? Or is this just another damaged person with their opinion on another person? We should write it off as such. I don't know, but it's interesting to have the show lay that out for us to ponder. One of my favorite lines, though, near the end, or nearer to about the closer to the end, was back and forth between Ellie and Dina. Of where Dina says, you know, you could have just asked me. And Ellie, very honestly, unquestionable, honest moment, I think, for her this episode, no, I actually didn't know that. And Dina's kind of smiling and saying back, now you do. That was a very open moment between the two of these, and I thought I really liked it quite a bit. Previously, it's just been kind of, you know, teenage flirting, whatever else. That was struck me as a very honest conversation in a way that's going to affect the two of them going forward. So I liked that quite a bit. And that looks like all the quotes I wrote down. Do any of those work for you, or are you going to annoy me and pick something completely different?
It's sort of different. You referenced the conversation, but I'm going to break the mold here in best line of the episode and do a bit of a monologue. It's sort of the whole thing.
Wow.
it comes from Gail, who's my favorite new character of the season. Turns out nature can only do this much. Nurture can only do this much. The rest is nature. If she's on a path, it's not one that Joel put her on. No, no. I think they were walking side by side from the very start. Tommy, I get it. You inherited her, and you want to keep her out of trouble. Take it from a psychotherapist of 40 years. Some people just can't be saved.
It's on my list. I didn't want to resign it, and I'm glad you did, though, because I'm with you that from a philosophical standpoint, this is what the show wants us to be thinking about as this character is now on her path of revenge. Can she be saved? Is this an inherent darkness in her that was just waiting to come out? Is this a series of people that are not treating her as she should and that she could have been set off differently? We have the show giving us an answer. I'm not convinced, though, that it is necessarily the only answer yet.
It has us asking questions about the broader themes of the show and what it's saying about humanity, especially in these highly, highly frayed, stressful situations. But also, like, if your focus is on the interpersonal, it also asks some questions about that, too. This line, I think they were walking side by side from the very start. Questions, I think, a lot of our assumptions about the nature of Ellie's relationship with Joel. It's like this idea that Joel was the leader and was saving her, leading her. And what Gail is positing here is that these were two similar souls from jump, and they worked together so well because they were alike, but not necessarily that one was influencing the other. They were more kind of partners in crime.
It's an interesting perspective on this, and one that I don't think we've entertained as much as we should. Winners and losers. You start with this one. Who do you have as winner of the episode?
Yeah. So Dina is my winner of the episode. For sure.
Solid choice. I think the only fallbacks there is I can't even put him in the same category, but Seth maybe is an honorable mention. But I feel like a co-winner with Dina, though again, it was just yada yada, but Jackson is a community, building off last episode, that they went through that, and 3 months later, they have a community in a town again. That's some impressive shit. It was off screen, so I can't give it same marks as Dina. I think Dina deserves it, but I think it's a more of an honorable mention than Seth would be.
So that is, I agree with you, but I think I agree with you for a slightly different reason. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the idea that a community can band together, you know, go to war and then rebuild. I think if human nature has a strength, I think that's one of the strengths of human nature. Like, we're under threat, we fight. But what's almost more impressive to me is that in the wake of that, they can make such a highly fraught emotional decision in such a rational, bureaucratic way. Mm-hmm. Do we go get our revenge? Yeah, the institutions are holding up, right? Like, no matter, do we go get our revenge on Joel's killer? They decided to make that in a way that they would have made it sans the emotions of the moment. Like, they stuck to the script. So shout out to them for that.
And they did not get distracted by lectures about corn, which that is always hard. You and I get distracted by that constantly, but they were able to persevere through that too.
Corn's a difficult crop.
Khrushchev would agree. It can be a mess of working with you, but it can be valuable. I think wait. No corn now. Do we have another segment we have to talk about?
Oh, okay. Almost got you. What's our segment?
Was there any other? I think we already kind of addressed, talking from the couch with Lee in terms of, you know, philosophical and psychological issues from this episode. But anything else to emphasize there? I'm with you that it was less subtext than it was text this episode for what they kind of wanted us to think about and ponder.
Yeah, Therapist Couch with Lee, you're not going to get rid of this segment. I've got more.
I gave you the opportunity.
Yeah, well, you kind of I think we already addressed it. Let's see if we can move on. You kind of gave me one of those. Look, here's the other thing I wanted to talk about in Therapy Time with Lee this week. Because obviously we've touched on a few things about nature, nurture, about how the people, how they're motivated, their interpersonal relationships and growth over time. I'd like to talk about grieving for a second. Ooh, because I think that we are going to get some interesting story beats about Ellie's grief and how she's dealing. And I think that, you know, the immediacy of what happened and her going in and out of reality and that hyper sort of fraught emotional response, I think, mm-hmm. Is something that we all could kind of understand. That's why they didn't have to spend very long on it. They just gave us her perspective. And we understood, okay, that's what she's going through. And then when she's at the grave, that sort of like sitting with the idea, the memory and what's left of the body of the person and grieving, I think that's something that we can all understand. But the thing that I think that like doesn't get talked about enough in grieving that I think is really important is the need to not be grieving for periods. Grieving doesn't you don't start grieving and then like on Tuesday you're like, all right, I'm good, I grieved. Like grieving is long.
Get it out of your system.
It takes a long time. And sometimes if you really loved the person, the entity, the thing, the dog that you are dealing with the grief of, it can go on for months and years and years. And you have, I think it's so important to carve out little periods where you're not grieving within mm-hmm. your grief. And it seems like that's what Ellie's able to do with grief, brief periods with Dina. Like, yes, Dina's important to the fact that Ellie can't like plan things and like probably wouldn't have brought a tent without her. Like she would have brought like 40 knives.
You're fine. Like, I got my chucks.
40 knives, 20 guns, and like two pieces of jerky. And that's probably what she would have brought. So Dina's important for that. But I also think it's important because she gives Ellie these brief moments where she can flirt and have fun and for a little while not grieve and then get back to her grief. I think that's important. There you go, Therapy Time Lee.
To do the broader than I think some of the characters we've discussed in this episode, but if there's anyone who has a hope of saving Ellie or at least giving her a different purpose in life, it's Dina, and it's a necessary part of why she's there with Ellie on this journey. If anyone can nuance her, redirect her, give her hope for the future, any life other than this, Dina's able to do that by being physically with Ellie. And I'm with you that associating, viewing your life as nothing but your grief is what we saw with Abby. If you only stew, if you only dwell, if you only immerse yourself in your pain, whatever else, and don't try to do something else with your life, then that's all you have and all you will ever be. And if Ellie has a hope, it's going to be in the form of Dina in the future. We stand to see whether that is going to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that thing, like you see somebody, you have a friend who's grieving, and if they're just like shattered on a couch all the time crying, like, maybe what that person needs is to talk about it, but probably what that person needs is like for you to figure out how can we get their mind on something else for a little while. I'm not telling you to like stop grieving or that it's inappropriate. What I'm telling you is that like watching a movie or going to dinner or going bowling, yeah, what the fuck ever for a little while will help. And the inverse is true too. Somebody who just went through a huge, you know, huge loss and all they're doing is the laughing, the joking, the bowling, the this, the that, then not that person probably needs to talk about it, right? Mm-hmm. The Abby parallel is such a good one because she clearly didn't have a Dina, or at least wasn't allowing a Dina to in her life. And so you got to be able to take those breaks from your grief and then get back to it. I like to see that Ellie's doing that. I'll tell you this, that in this episode, Ellie's dealing with her grief way more healthy than I thought she was. Now, of course, everything she said to fucking Gail was bullshit, but the what we're actually seeing from her when she's being honest, I don't know. It's better than I thought. I thought she'd be a fucking crazed psychotic zombie. Like I thought she'd be murdering people to get out of Jackson. Like, and she's not that yet. So I don't know. You've beaten the expectation for me.
Last most important question. I have two either ors to ask you that the episode presented, Fleetwood Mac or Frank Zappa?
Fleetwood Mac. And it's not close.
It isn't at all for me. Like, respect for Frank Zappa fans, but Fleetwood Mac wins that one in a heartbeat. Green Day versus Guns N' Roses.
Green Day, and that one also isn't close.
That one's a bit closer for me, but I think I'm going to go in favor with Green Day, too. And yes, Ozzy Osbourne wins everything.
Do you know who wrote Knocking on Heaven's Door?
What?
Do you know who wrote Knocking on Heaven's Door?
I don't, offhand.
Anytime somebody's like, hey, do you know who wrote? You should just always say Bob Dylan.
Fair. Very fair. Bob Dylan, Watchtower, and everything else to follow.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, Bob Dylan. I just watched A Complete Unknown last night. What a movie! So good. That shout out. That's a good one to watch.
If they come back around to the B's and the D's, we'll see whether they pick the well-deserved winner of those categories.
Yeah, you better pick Dylan on that one, Dana.
Anything further, sir?
That's all I got. You know, I'm enjoying season two more than I thought I would. This has been good.
You seem like you are. I'm glad. Episode one, you seem like you're having a certain measure of resistance about what the show could be, and it seems like it's working for you.
Yeah. What about you?
It is. I mean, I can see how the show may frustrate me in the future because, I'll be honest, revenge stories aren't really my jam. They're not something I particularly enjoy. They're an entire genre that I've just never particularly liked, and I picture that's a lot of what this is going to be. But the show's already kind of leveled out that it's not going to be the, oh, revenge feels good kind of story, that they're going to go heavily into a lot of gray and a lot of conflicted themes and a lot of what the psychology is at play for our characters. I'm looking forward to that, even if the overall arc of the series is going to be something that I'm going to be frustrated with. But I think the show wants me to be.
Yeah, I think that's a fair read. That all makes sense to me. All right. Well, we are going to do our... We promised at the start of our coverage for this season that we would do a long episode, which is where we go line by line through the script, break each and every scene down. Usually takes us for an hour-long show, between somewhere between 2.5 and 3 hours. We said we'd do that twice this season. We are going to do that next week. So next week, our guy Spencer, my podcast co-host, is going to be leading the recap for episode 4, and then I will lead it for the season finale. And so that's how we're going to break it down. So you got the short form podcast today where we just sort of talk our feelings, talk about the episode. We will be breaking the episode down line by line through the script next week in a long form podcast episode. Spencer, anything else you want to say before we break?
I'm just looking up the title of the episode that apparently has not been published, but I can't say. I'm looking forward to talking about it in detail with you.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back.